Testing. Testing. Testing.
Good evening. Good evening and welcome. My name is Beverly Lapp, and I am director of the core curriculum and professor of music here at Goshen College. I'm also a member of the Yoder Public Affairs Committee, which is chaired by Professor Emeritus of Economics, Del Good. Other members of the committee are GC faculty Jan Shetler and Dwayne Stolzfus, Provost Ken Newbold, and Richard Aguirre of the Advancement Office. The Frank and Betty Jo Yoder Public Affairs Lecture Series is an endowed lectureship created for Goshen College in 1978 by Frank and Betty Jo Yoder of Goshen, with the goal of enabling faculty, students, and community to hear well-known speakers address current issues. So as a committee, we're delighted to welcome you here this evening to hear from Mike Tidwell, author, filmmaker, and executive director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Over 3 years ago, as faculty members for the first year Identity, Culture, and Community course at Goshen College reviewed various book options, we knew we wanted a good story that gave our students a unique insight into cross-cultural learning. As an institution that has long prioritized international and intercultural studies in our general education curriculum, we hoped to find a book that would help students think about how to be thoughtful cross-cultural learners from their first day on campus. As we read The Ponds of Columbine, a Peace Corps memoir by Mike Tidwell, we were captured by the storytelling, the remarkable honesty, and the powerful message of how interconnected our world is. We knew we had found our good story. At various times over these 3 years of Goshen College first year and transfer students reading this book, we have wondered, wouldn't it be great for our students to hear from the author in person? We're so pleased to have Mike here not only for tonight's lecture and tomorrow's 10 a.m. convocation about climate change, but also for a talk about Ponds of Columbine with the first full year cohort at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Tomorrow's 9 a.m. and 10 a.m. sessions are in this space as well, and all are welcome. Mike Tidwell lived in Central Congo from 1985 to 1987, where the Peace Corps sent him to teach fish culture. While the sometimes humorous, other times heartbreaking stories of his time there are about a North American finding his way in a culture and a place very different from what he knew, these were also years that inspired his current work in sustainability. In his 2011 introduction to the book, Mike reflects on how President Kennedy's vision for the Peace Corps to take volunteers from the so-called solution nation, the U.S., to transfer knowledge and technology to problem nations is now turned on its head. He writes in this intro, quote, "We in the United States have become the world's leading problem nation. We are now a direct and daily burden on all of the world's poor, threatening to unravel whatever help we managed to provide in the past. How are we doing this? Simple. We are destroying the world's atmosphere with greenhouse gas pollution. We are changing the climate," unquote. The pressing and devastating reality of climate change is building in urgency as the impact of first world living takes its toll on the world's poorest nations. We are privileged to hear tonight from someone who has seen this impact firsthand and now advocates passionately for policy change and motivates individuals and communities around the U.S. to do their part to alter the tragic course of global warming. Following his talk, there will be time for conversation with Mike, and you may come to one of these microphones to ask any questions you may have. Please join me now in offering a warm welcome to the 2015 Yoder Public Affairs Lecturer, Mike Tidwell, as he asks and perhaps answers, "Will Indiana overheat or become a clean energy paradise?" Welcome, Mike.
Thank you for that introduction. I want to thank Beverly Lapp for finding me and bringing me here to Goshen. Beautiful community. I've already had a great 24 hours here and learned so much and seen so much. And I want to thank all of you for coming. It's a great honor to be your guest speaker for the Yoder Public Affairs Lecture, and just a real honor to be here. I'm a Presbyterian myself, but I feel like in different times in my life I've been touched by Mennonite people. One, when I was a kid growing up in Georgia, there was a Mennonite family that moved in next door from Virginia, and they were the Jimson family, and I don't know why, but the Jimsons had all these really great Bible storybooks with the great illustrations, you know, Joseph's coat of many colors, and I just loved their storybooks, Bible storybooks they had, and sometimes my sister and I would go over and hang out with the Jimson kids, and Mrs. Jimson would read us some of the Bible storybooks, and I remember one that I was deeply moved by. She told the story from the book about this traveler in biblical times who was going down the road and got robbed by these bad guys and thrown in a ditch along the road, and then one person came by and didn't help this poor traveler who had been robbed and beaten, and then a second traveler came by and was robbed, and then finally didn't help, the second traveler didn't, then a third person came by and finally helped this person in the ditch. And I remember being moved, and when my mom came home that night, I went home, I was so excited, and I told her, I said, "I just learned this story, and there was a traveler who was robbed, and then finally, the goodest American came by, and this goodest American saved this traveler back in the biblical times." And I don't know why, I've just always remembered Mrs. Jimson for telling me that story. It has been great to be here today. Earlier, I had the great privilege of visiting your Mary Lee Environmental Center, where you have, I think, 1,100 acres of forest and prairie. It's, for someone from the East Coast, it's really great to see prairie being restored, and to know that, you know, this is wonderful alluvial soil, or soil that was basically pushed here by the great glaciers of the last ice age that create the wonderful soil that makes Indiana so famous. And it's just amazing to be here so close to the Great Lakes themselves that were dug out by these massive glaciers during the last ice age. I mean, imagine so much ice, so powerful that it could scoop out, you know, lakes virtually the size of oceans. And, you know, it's interesting to think about that, how much different our climate system is today compared to a climate system that could scoop out the Great Lakes. I mean, over New York City, for example, what is today New York City, 12,000 years ago at the peak of the last ice age, there was a glacier so huge that it measured a mile thick from its base to its top. A mile thick. Anybody know how many degrees the planet has warmed from a climate system that gets you a mile thick glacier over New York City and the different weather system? Today, we obviously don't have that glacier. We have the green grass of Yankee Stadium in New York City today. Anybody know how many degrees the planet has warmed? It's about between 4 and 6 degrees Fahrenheit. That's it, 4 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit. And you get the difference between a mile thick glacier over New York and the New York we have today. And now the Pope was here last week. He was in New York City. He met with scientists and policymakers. And they discussed the fact that our best science now says that if we continue to pollute the atmosphere, we could get not 4 degrees of warming, not 6 degrees, but as much as 10 degrees of warming Fahrenheit over the next 100 years. Imagine that. If 4 to 6 degrees of warming gets you the difference between a mile thick glacier over New York and the New York we know today, what is 10 degrees on the other side going to get us? It's just unfathomable. In our children's lifetimes, the world that we could live in will be utterly unrecognizable to the weather system that we have today. We know what's causing this warming. We know what's bringing on to the world changes of virtually ice age significance. It's our burning of oil, coal, and natural gas. When you burn these so-called fossil fuels, one byproduct is an odorless, invisible gas called carbon dioxide. It migrates to the atmosphere, stays up there for about 100 years, and it traps heat. It's pretty straightforward science. It's not natural causes. Yes, in the past, ice ages have come and gone. We've had warm periods, and they've been caused by natural causes. Sunspots, solar flares, the fact that the Earth wobbles a little bit on its axis. There have been, for the history of the planet, natural causes to changes in climate. But this one is not natural. This one is being caused by us, by human activity. This warming that we're now imposing on ourselves is not in our best interest. You know, wherever I go in the world, I ask people, you know, what have they seen in terms of strange weather? What have they seen, especially people who've been on the planet for a few years? And earlier today, I had the opportunity to ask some Goshen students and faculty, what have they seen here in this part of Indiana over recent years? And the stories were pretty amazing. Some of the folks who were a little bit older described their grandparents telling stories of when they were kids. You know, the ponds and lakes froze over for most of the winter. You know, you could dependably ice skate in most bodies of water for most of the winter. And that was the grandparents. And then the parents, the next generation, you know, growing up in the 60s and 70s, it would be occasional. You know, it wasn't all winter long that the ponds would freeze. And now the kids now, I mean, it's not uncommon to have a winter where most of the ponds and lakes don't freeze at all enough to support skaters. So these are the changes that we're seeing in temperature just in our lifetime. At Mary Lee Environmental Center, on that plot of land, just as recently as the 1980s, there would be an annual cross-country skiing weekend that the college would organize, and students would go and faculty would go and just pick a weekend in January, February, have a cross-country weekend where everybody would cross-country ski. Cannot do that now. It's not certain that any one weekend in the winter will have enough snow for cross-country skiing, and so there's a lot less of that now. And used to be that shops in downtown Goshen would sell cross-country skis. It was very common to buy cross-country skis. You don't see that anymore. And while that may sound almost anecdotal, we know that the science backs this up. We know, for example, that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has said that many of the plants that our parents and grandparents could have grown in Indiana are no longer meet the USDA's recommendations in terms of their hardiness zones. Trees like blue spruces are moving further north because of the warming that's happening. And gardeners see this, farmers see this. So we know that this is happening. There's both the anecdotal, there's the measurable science that shows that even here in Indiana, in the heartland, many changes are afoot. But unfortunately, these are just the beginnings. You know, the science now tells us, and the Pope's message last week, is that this is accelerating. And as the president has said, we are the first generation to really live with, to feel the consequences of climate change, and we could be the last generation to have a chance to do something about it. That we could see as much as 5, 6, 7 feet of sea level rise in our coastal cities, and massive heat waves that threaten agriculture itself. But the biggest threat now and into the future is to the world's poorest and most vulnerable. You know, I often spend a lot of time, you know, thinking about the Jimson family and the story of the goodest American. And as a climate activist now, as an adult, I wonder, are we being good Americans? Are we being good Americans to hear the call of the scientists and to hear the call of the Pope and people of faith and to take action? And I submit to you, not yet. We haven't been the good Americans that we need to be. You know, I became a climate activist almost 15 years ago, and I wanted to just share with you some of the reasons that I became a climate activist, the motivations that have led me to be in front of you here tonight speaking about this topic. Three main motivations. Number one is my son, Michael Alexander Tidwell, born May 30th, 1997, now a freshman in college like many of you. He is the world to me, absolutely the whole world to me. And I live in fear and concern every day because of climate change that my son will have a fraction of the opportunities in his lifetime that I've had in my lifetime because of climate change. And I share that same concern for the future of all of you young people here today. So number one, my motivation is my son. Number two is my Christian faith. I know that this glorious creation of a planet is not ours to destroy. We are taught in the Bible that this glorious gift is ours to be stewards of, not to have reckless dominion over. So my faith motivates me. My third motivation is my Peace Corps experience. As Beverly said, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Congo, in the very center of Africa. And it was a life-changing, completely life-changing experience. I started the Peace Corps as a 22-year-old, had to learn how to speak a very complex African language called Chiluba, had no running water, no electricity, really no roads, no telephones to call, non-existent hospitals if you get into trouble. I remember getting to my outpost in the Peace Corps, and my Peace Corps boss dropped me off in a Land Rover. We unloaded all my stuff. I moved into my small mud-walled house that I lived in, and then he gave me a book that startled me, and every Peace Corps volunteer in Africa, and I think across much of the planet, still gets this book. The book is called Where There Is No Doctor. And it's just a manual on all the things that can go wrong with you and all the things you should try to do because there ain't no doctor around. But this was an amazing experience living among some of the poorest people on the continent, people who were nonetheless some of the most generous that I've ever met, people who would give you everything that they had to a foreigner, who would help a traveler, who were very, very good people. But you know, when it comes to climate change in this community that I lived in, people who lived in houses with thatched grass roofs and mud-walled houses, it wasn't a matter of clean wind-powered electricity versus dirty coal-fired electricity. As I said before, they didn't have any electricity. It wasn't a question of cleaner hybrid Prius cars versus dirty gas-guzzling SUVs. They didn't have cars at all. There were barely any roads or bridges. These are people in the Congo, in the small village I lived in, who contribute almost nothing at all to climate change. Africa as a continent, almost 1 billion people, generates about 3 to 4% of all the world's greenhouse gases. Contributes almost nothing. And yet these same people are, as we speak, being walloped by the unusual droughts, the unexpected ravenous floods that come at the wrong time of year, the whole pattern, the whole rhythm of the seasons, where you plant in September and when the rains come and you get steady rains throughout the fall and you harvest that first corn crop in December and January, then you plant the second crop during the second rainy season from January to May, and then the dry season comes in June, July, August. Those ancient patterns that allowed subsistence agriculture to exist in Central Africa are being disrupted tremendously. The rainy seasons don't come. The dry season lasts too long. And you know, when we experience droughts and floods in the United States, you know, the price of a particular food might go up a little bit. The cost of a burrito at Chipotle might be a little bit more expensive because of the California drought. So we choose something else, or we pay the extra 10 cents for that burrito. In the Congo, when the rains don't come, it's food off the table, completely off the table. Children are hungry because of climate change. All over the world today, as I speak. Now, in a perfect world, a country like the United States that generates 25% of all the world's greenhouse gases, even though we only have about 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's greenhouse gases. In a perfect world, if the world were truly fair, the United States would get 25% of all the planet's warming telescoped right down on our nation, right? That would be fair. And if we were to get our fair share of the warming, then our country would already be wrecked. Our economy would be destroyed. Florida would already be a series of islands. Kansas would be a scrub desert. But since we can share the warming with Africa and share the warming with South Pacific Island nations that are literally disappearing because of sea level rise, and share the warming with Bangladeshis, we just don't get that worked up about it in the United States. We know what we're doing, and we continue to do it because we can share the problem with the rest of the world. And I submit to you that this is utterly and completely, totally, morally unacceptable. It is wrong what we are doing, and it does not make us good Americans. You know, when I was 28 years old, I read an amazing book that changed my life. I was telling some students earlier today that, you know, I don't remember many newspaper articles I've read that have truly changed my life. I'm not sure how many magazine articles have changed my life. I know that no tweets have ever changed my life or Facebook postings. But books have changed my life. And I think that for most of you, books have helped change your life. And I know in your 4-year journey here at Goshen, many great books will change your life. One book that changed my life was a book by the writer Bill McKibben, who I know has also been to this campus. A great writer and environmental activist, Bill wrote a book in 1988 called The End of Nature. At the time, I was a young man. I was a broke writer myself. I had to wait till the paperback came out because I couldn't afford the hardcover. I read Bill's book, The End of Nature, in 1990, and it completely changed who I am. It was like a BCAD moment for me. Bill's book was the first book for a mass audience about the reality of climate change, about what's causing it, about the profound sadness of the impacts of climate change on the natural world, on the world's forests and the Arctic regions and rivers and fish. Everything changes. When you change the atmosphere, you change everything. And Bill laid out for me the first time I'd really learned what was causing it, the use of fossil fuels. And that we were so locked in and so addicted to fossil fuels that unless we change radically and soon, that climate change was going to be the number one issue that we deal with over the next 100 years. It would be the central organizing principle of everything that we do, of how we live our lives, of how we grow food or don't grow food, of how we have peace in the world because nations can get along, or we have so much disruption, so much drought, so much extreme weather that civilization itself becomes difficult. And I read Bill's book, and I remember, it's one of those books where I remember the sofa that I read most of it on. I remember the color of that sofa. I remember the wallpaper on the wall. I just remember that moment when my life changed because of this book. And I realized that this was going to be a great definer of my future. But something really strange happened after I read Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature, in 1990. I went into a state of denial for about 10 years. I didn't deny that climate change was happening. I understood it fully. I saw the press stories about continued climate change and various reports from scientists. But I somehow was able to convince myself that it wasn't going to get bad enough anytime soon, that it was going to affect me and the people I love to an extent that I had to do something about it. So I sort of kept it at arm's length. I kind of denied that it was really there. But then I had a very interesting experience in the late 1990s. This was toward the very end of my denial period. I was a freelance writer. I was doing a lot of freelance writing for the Washington Post. And I had an editor call me up and ask me to go to Louisiana and write a travel story about the Cajun people of South Louisiana for the Sunday travel section of the Washington Post. He said, I don't care how you write the story, I'm not going to tell you where to go, but just go down and write about Cajun culture. So I flew to New Orleans, I got a car, I had a backpack with me, and I decided that I was going to hitchhike through the Bayou region of South Louisiana, the Cajun region of Louisiana, not hitchhike by car, but to hitchhike by boat. Because so many of the Cajun people in South Louisiana virtually live on their boats. Bayou is just a Choctaw Indian word that means sluggish, slow-moving stream, because South Louisiana is so flat from 7,000 years of Mississippi River flooding. It's a giant floodplain. Flat, flat, flat. So the rivers are ponderous, curvaceous, slow-moving rivers called bayous. And I thought, I'm going to try to hitchhike through South Louisiana along the bayous. So I had my backpack, I had my REI issue sleeping bag bungee corded onto the back. And I went down to Bayou Lafourche, one of the main bayous in South Louisiana, and I saw a shrimper on a wooden shrimp boat with his teenage sons getting their nets ready and putting ice on the boat. And I talked my way onto this boat. I said, I just want to go wherever you're going. And they didn't understand what I was asking. I said, I'm a writer. I just want to write about your culture, and I just want to hitchhike. You know, take me wherever. Drop me off down the bayou. I'll get another ride on a crab boat or an oyster boat. And it worked. And I talked my way onto this shrimp boat, and I spent the next week, this is June of 1999, hitchhiking, having this amazing Huck Finn adventure with people barely recognizable as my countrymen, people who speak French better than they speak English, most of whom never owned a credit card, never been in an airplane, never seen a hill, never seen a hill. They've only seen flat ground. And I spent a week, the first ride I got was from a Cajun shrimper named Papoose Lede, classic Cajun name. And he started taking me through the wetlands and the bayous of South Louisiana, and I heard the music and the language and the beautiful landscape. But he told me, this was June of 1999, he told me an hour within our first conversation, as I'm taking notes and asking about this wonderful wetland landscape of South Louisiana and asking questions about the language, he said, whoa, 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 don't get too attached. Don't fall in love with our culture and our landscape. And I'm like, well, why are you saying that? He said, because we're going to get wiped out. All of this landscape and we, the people of South Louisiana, are going to get wiped out soon. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, and he didn't know what to call her at the time, but he said over and over again, essentially, Katrina is coming. A massive hurricane is going to wipe us out in South Louisiana. And I said, well, why are you saying that? And he explained to me, Papoose Lede, the fact that South Louisiana is the fastest disappearing landmass on Earth because we've shackled the Mississippi River in levees, and we no longer allow the Mississippi River to to flood anymore. The great land builder, the river that brought, you know, soil from as far away as Indiana down the Mississippi River and deposited it in flooding in South Louisiana. That whole ragged soil, the Louisiana boot, was made by the river. And we've shackled that river and she no longer floods. And on top of that, the oil and gas industry has scissored 10,000 miles of canals and channels through the wetlands, causing massive erosion. And then on top of that, sea level rise from climate change is eroding this land further, so that the barrier islands of South Louisiana have almost virtually disappeared prior to Katrina in 1999 when I was there. The wetlands were fragmented. There were open space where wetlands and entire forests had been only 20 or 30 years ago. And Pathbusa Lede pointed out all this evidence. Cemeteries in water in small towns in South Louisiana because of the flooding and the loss of the wetlands. And he told me, Katrina is coming. Katrina is coming. And all the fishermen told me that. They didn't know what to call her, but they said a hurricane is coming. And then I went back home, and I couldn't let that story go. I needed to write about this threat to South Louisiana. So I wrote a whole book that was published in 2003. And it sounds like I wrote it after Katrina. The title of the book is Bayou Farewell, The Rich Life and Tragic Death of Louisiana's Cajun Coast. And really what I was doing was just trying to give voice to these fishing people, these poor Cajun fishing people who were telling me, their countrymen, that because the wetlands had disappeared, the barrier islands were gone, because of the oil and gas activity and all these human activities, that there was no protection from hurricanes anymore. The barrier islands that usually slow down the hurricanes were gone. The wetlands that usually slow down the surge tide were gone. And that meant that all could be lost. So I wrote this book in 2003, and then, of course, Katrina came, and then Rita, and so much was lost, and so many lives were lost, and we just marked the 10th anniversary of that giant storm last month. And you know what's really interesting, and when I was writing that book, Bayou Farewell, and I'm sitting at my writing table back in Maryland, and I'm writing this whole story prophesizing a major hurricane striking South Louisiana for all the ecological destruction that had been caused there. As I was writing, I started to ask myself, well, you know, I was basically writing a book about a modern American coastal society that was committing group suicide, that knew the danger was coming, knew that the ecological unsustainability of human activity was setting the table for this disaster, but yet nonetheless stayed as a whole coastal society in denial, did not organize to do something, did not mobilize resources to protect themselves, did not change their patterns of activity toward a more sustainable pattern. A form of group suicide in a modern American society. And as I was writing a whole book about this, prophesizing Katrina, I suddenly asked myself, well, if it's happening here in South Louisiana, where else is it happening? And that's when I realized it's happening everywhere. We are all New Orleanians because the exact same thing is happening with climate change. We know what's causing it. We know our combustion of oil, coal, and natural gas is changing the atmosphere, raising the temperature, raising the ocean levels. We understand the science completely, and yet we're not acting. We're not protecting ourselves at the level we should be. We are not mobilizing with the same moral and practical passion that the Pope called on us to do last week. And that's when I finally, when I was writing this book in the early 2000s, and I realized we are all New Orleanians, I realized I had to do something about it. I had to get involved. You know, and when I first really started to take climate change seriously and realize how bad it was in the early 2000s, I first went through this period of anger. I was angry because my life was great. I had a job where I got to go hitchhike on a Cajun fishing boat through Louisiana. I would do stories for National Geographic magazine walking across Sicily, you know, with a backpack, sleeping in almond groves in Sicily and writing stories about it. I had a charmed, wonderful life. I didn't want my life to change. But I knew I had to make changes. And I got mad. How come other people aren't doing? Why aren't the campuses rioting over this? You know, my friends who are musicians and poets, they're not setting their art aside to become climate activists. Why do I have to do it? And I just got mad because my neighbors weren't out there. No one else was really outraged and out in the streets protesting. And then I realized, Mike, why are you angry? You're not out there. You're not out there doing anything about this. You're not organizing. You're not speaking. You're not advocating for clean energy alternatives to fossil fuels. How can you possibly get angry at anyone else? And that's when the battle was over. My 10-year period of denial, you know, this was now more than 10 years since I read Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature, finally came to an end, and I realized I had to dedicate the rest of my life to this issue. Not necessarily because I wanted to, but because I had a personal obligation to my son, to my faith, to the people in the Congo where I was a Peace Corps volunteer. And so I made changes. I decided that there was no way I was going to stand in front of an audience, for example, at Goshen College and ask all of you to make changes and change the way you live and the way you vote and the way you conduct your life. I was going to ask anybody to make changes in their lives until I had made all the changes I could possibly make in my own life. And so in 2001, when I had this epiphany, I'm writing Bayou Farewell, I realized we are all New Orleanians. I knew I needed to make changes in my personal life first, so I put solar panels on my roof. I planted a native plant garden in my front yard. I became a vegetarian. I mean, I became obnoxiously green, just hideously green in my life. I also installed a corn-burning stove, a stove that burns corn kernels, organically fertilized corn kernels that I get from a Mennonite farmer in Carroll County, Maryland, about 40 miles from my house. It was actually, I heard about these corn-burning stoves. I wanted to get off fossil fuels as much as I could. And I saw a story on CBS News about these ingenious stoves, not wood pellet stoves, but stoves that burn corn kernels. And I did some research, and I found out that if you grow the corn the right way, if you don't till the soil, it allows the soil to absorb a lot of CO2 from the atmosphere. And if you don't use fossil fuel fertilizers, but you use organic fertilizers, then that corn burned in your stove at home is much better for the climate than gas or oil. And so I started looking around and trying to find farmers near me who didn't till their soil and used organic fertilizers, and I soon found this Mennonite farmer named Gary Ball in Carroll County, and Gary was happy to sell me his corn, and then quickly, it grew from me with a corn stove to now there's 70 families in the D.C. area who heat their homes with corn stoves. And we needed a place to store the corn. So Gary told me, you know, what you need is an urban corn granary, a silo. You need a granary where you live. And I convinced the mayor and city council of my town at Tacoma Park to let us buy a corn granary. And we put in, now Gary in the winter every month brings his feed truck down and he augers the corn into our granary and people come in an honor system and heat their homes. And there's a second granary now in Mount Rainier, Maryland, where a student, Cecilia, who I met earlier today, is from Mount Rainier. And there's a corn granary in her neighborhood in Maryland as well. We feel great about it. We reduce our carbon footprint. We heat our home with Maryland-grown corn from a great family farm, and everybody wins. So I made all these changes in my life, and then I was ready to get busy. And that's when I formed my organization, the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. I looked around. The year was 2001, 2002. I wanted to join another group. I was like, okay, I've gone hideously green. I've made all the changes I can make. Now I want to get busy. I want to start advocating and I want activism. And I was looking for a group that had global warming as their top priority, not a priority, but their top priority in clean energy solutions. And when I looked around, the Sierra Club had global warming as an issue, but it wasn't their top priority. The League of Conservation Voters, Nature Conservancy, all these groups, none of them had it as their top priority. And there's sometimes in life when the group you want to belong to doesn't exist, you form your own group. So not knowing anything about the nonprofit world, not knowing anything about organizing, I decided I was going to form a global warming clean energy group. We gave it the name the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. It started with me and a laptop in my home in 2002, and now we're 17, a staff of 17 with an office in Tacoma Park, an office in Richmond and Baltimore, and we promote clean energy solutions to climate change. And I just want to say to all of you who are thinking about futures in environmental work, don't let anyone tell you you can't do it. Don't let anyone tell you you don't have the right background or you don't have this or that, because I was totally unprepared to start advocating. But what I had was passion, determination, and a commitment to all the loved ones in my life that I was going to do something about it, and that will take you a long way. And so today, that's what I do. I spend most days advocating, lobbying, writing op-eds, and pushing for clean energy solutions. And the good news is that those solutions are everywhere. We don't need a magic bullet to solve climate change. We don't need lots of new research into fancy gadgets that don't exist yet. Everything we need to solve climate change, we already have. Hybrid cars, electric cars, energy-efficient appliances, wind power, solar. We lack nothing to completely decarbonize our economy in America and around the world. What we lack is the political will to make it happen. We're a nation of laws. We're a nation of laws. And if you want to change this nation, you have to change the laws. And it can't be voluntary. You know, it's great to go green. I've gone green. Many of you in this room I know have gone green. The college itself voluntarily has made extraordinary progress in cutting its carbon footprint and should be commended for all the great things that have happened on this campus, more than most campuses I've visited. But to really make change happen everywhere, you have to change laws. For example, during the Civil Rights Movement, you know, the Civil Rights Movement, we didn't go down into little southern towns and ask the bigoted college presidents, please, could you integrate voluntarily maybe every other Saturday? No, sometimes in this world, the moral wrong is so profound, the moral urgency is so great, that you have to ban the offending practice. You have to command by statute the solution. And that's where we are with climate change. We have to pass laws that mandate clean energy, mandate the phasing out of oil, coal, and natural gas. And that's what I do, and that's what I recommend that you commit as much of your time to doing, advocating for real solutions. Just today at the Mary Lee Environmental Education Center, I had the great honor and privilege of seeing a 10-kilowatt wind turbine busily creating electricity this afternoon when I was there. Lots and lots of solar panels providing almost 100% of the energy of one facility and about a third or half of several other facilities. This stuff works. I know, because I have solar panels on my roof. You know, no one can tell me it can't be done. I got a corn-burning stove, for God's sake. You know, my carbon footprint is ridiculously small, and I did it while saving money. But we've got to do this across our country. And you know, right here in Indiana, one of the solar panels that I saw today, what's interesting is I know it's cloudy a lot of days here, but the solar panels perform beautifully even on cloudy days. The technology is so good now. And the wind, there's lots of wind resources to be harvested here in Indiana. I know in central and western Indiana, we're already seeing the development of a modern utility-scale wind industry, and it's positive. But we have to go faster. The state of California, as we speak today, the average Californian uses half the electricity as the rest of the country uses, half the electricity that the average person in Indiana uses. How do they do it? Through policies. Since the 1970s, California has mandated energy-efficient appliances, energy-efficient building standards, wind power, solar. California is doing it. They are setting the trend for the rest of the world, and it's up to us to catch up, and we can do it. But in the meantime, as we're racing against the clock, trying to get off fossil fuels as fast as we can, even as we now have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than at any point in at least a million years of known natural history on this planet, a million years, scientists now can tell, we've got more CO2 in the atmosphere now than at any point in the last million years. Even so, as the scientists tell us that this is a danger, and as the Pope and many of our leaders remind us that we have to take action, what is the fossil fuel industry doing? Is ExxonMobil absolutely investing tremendously in wind and solar? No, they're doubling down on more exotic oil, offshore drilling in more dangerous areas of the Gulf of Mexico, tapping tar sands oil in Canada, wanting to build a massive pipeline to bring the dirtiest, filthiest oil you can possibly bring from Canada to the rest of the world. Fracking. Instead of moving to more wind power, the gas industry wants to drill a mile deep in many areas of the Midwest and then drill horizontally for a mile through shale areas, put explosives down there, set off the explosions. The shrapnel from the pipes containing the TNT then punctures the shale rock all around. Then you pump down millions of gallons of water full of toxic chemicals to force the gas to the surface. And then pipe that gas through farmlands where it leaks at every mile, thousands of miles, till it finally gets to a power plant that emits more global warming pollution. We would rather do that than build wind power. We'd rather do that than put solar panels on every roof. The fossil fuel industry, instead of getting off of fossil fuels, they're doubling down on more and more exotic fossil fuels, more and more dangerous and dirty fossil fuels at exactly the wrong moment in human history, with tar sands and fracking and deep sea drilling. It's sort of like a heroin addict. We're addicted to fossil fuels. Heroin addicts will keep shooting up even as the veins collapse and the health becomes poor, and it's a classic signs of addiction. But the one thing we know in this country, and Winston Churchill said it best, the one thing you can count on Americans is Americans can always be counted on to do the right thing after exhausting all other possibilities. And I think we're about there. We're close to exhausting all the possibilities. There's no way out to stay on fossil fuels and solve the climate crisis. So fossil fuels have got to go, and they are going. So much is being done in this country. So many great movements. The divestment movement in campuses across this country is inspiring people everywhere, demanding the colleges get off of fossil fuels, stop investing in fossil fuels, start investing more and more of their endowments in clean energy. It can't happen overnight. No college or school can navigate the complexities of investments overnight and completely get off fossil fuels, but it can be done. And there are schools that have done it completely. And it will be done across this country, and I'm sure right here at Goshen. So there's much that's being done. And I just want to leave you with a couple of thoughts. A lot of people hear me talk. They hear me talk about the urgency, about the fact that we've got to do something, that we have a moral obligation to be the goodest Americans that we can be. And they say, okay, give me one thing I should do. Tell me what's the best single thing that I do. Please don't give me a list of 10 things that I need to do. Give me one thing that's the most important thing. And my answer is always the same. Find a group as close to where you live that is fighting climate change. Find an organization that has got it together, that is truly organized and active, as close to where you live, that's fighting for clean energy solutions. Find that group and then do something very, very simple. Sign up for their email list. Get their email alerts. That's it. That's my one thing I advise you to do. Because if you do that, you will start to get the information. You will start to learn about the next rally. You will start to learn about the important legislation on Capitol Hill or in the state capitol. You will learn about voluntary things that you can do. You will meet a new community. You will develop a relationship with a group of people making change happen. That's the important thing. Develop a relationship with a group that's working on this issue. Right here in Indiana, there's a great group, the Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light Group, that is fantastic, especially for people of faith who want to do something on climate change. I am on the steering committee of the Greater Washington Interfaith Power and Light Group. And I will tell you, that is a great place to start. But just find one group, whether it's the Sierra Club or the Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light Group. Find a group, get on their email list, and start developing a relationship with that group. And do all that you can. We really are running out of time. You know, my sports-crazed son has asked me, are we going to make it? are we going to do it? You know, Dad, I've heard you give some of your talks. It can sound pretty depressing. Sounds pretty dire. Are we really going to pull this out? And so I can communicate with him. I use a sports metaphor. I say, well, son, you know, we're sort of like a football team, down by 2 touchdowns with less than 2 minutes to go, and we have no timeouts. Now, has any football team ever come back and won a game under those circumstances? Down by 2 touchdowns, no timeouts. Yes, of course. At the high school level, college level, NFL level, it's not that common, but it happens. And what does it take to make it happen? It takes great leadership, a great battle plan. It takes enormous teamwork. Everybody's got to work together. And it also takes a little bit of luck. So the first two things we can do on our own, we can provide leadership in our community. We can be part of a team that's working on this issue full steam. And then we can pray and we can hope and we can wish for the best. I know in my heart that we can do it. I believe that we will do it, but we will only do it if we all come together and work on this issue and truly become the good Americans that I know that we can be. Thank you very much. Great. I think this is a part where you guys get to ask me some questions. And we have 2 microphones right here.
You mentioned that your faith was a factor in your involvement in the fight against climate change, but in your memoir, you seemed very cynical about religion. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the change that occurred in your life.
That's a great question. I forgot you people are actually reading my book. I grew up a Southern Baptist in Georgia. The whole nine yards, church, Sunday school, choir. We went to church on Wednesday nights also. My family was totally involved in the Southern Baptist Church in Georgia. But then when I was 13 and began to think for myself and sort of connect dots for myself, I told my parents one Sunday morning, I'm not going to church anymore. And they said, what do you mean you're not going to? But this is what we do on Sunday mornings. We go to church. And I said, yeah, I don't feel like I belong there. And they said, why? And I said, because at this church, this Southern Baptist Conservative Church, I said, the number one emotion that I feel when I'm at that church and that I associate with this church is fear. And I said, it doesn't make sense. Why am I afraid of God? Why am I afraid of all these things the church tells us not to do? It just didn't add up for me. And my parents said, well, you still got to go. And I said, no, I'm not going to go. So I boycotted church. And then for 20 years, I was a recovering Southern Baptist. I didn't stop going to church completely. I would have friends who were very active in their churches. And I was still drawn to that spiritual connection. And the voice of God was still there. Even though I didn't know it, I really thought that Christianity wasn't for me for about 20 years, but I would still go to church now and again, and I always enjoyed it. And then I was living overseas in Central Asia, so when I wrote the book Ponza Kalambai, I was in that phase of thinking Christianity wasn't for me. But later, in my early 30s, I was living in Central Asia in the former Soviet Union, where my wife was deputy director of the Peace Corps program there, and I started listening to a radio program on, I don't know if it was Voice of America or what, but a radio program of this great country Kentucky preacher who had a great Kentucky draw, but nonetheless was very progressive and very, just an amazing storyteller, a great, great Christian voice. And I started finding myself listening to this program on Sundays on the radio, thinking, this is innocent, no harm done. I just really enjoy hearing him talk. He's a great storyteller. And then one day I was listening to this program on the radio and on the other side of the planet, and this preacher said, you know, faith is an interesting thing, and we find different ways, pathways to faith. And for example, you listening to me right now on the radio, if you don't believe in God and Christianity, why are you listening to me right now? And I realized that it had not gone away, and that in my heart and in my soul, I was still a Christian. And I began the path back to the church, not a Southern Baptist church, but I found a great, wonderful church that was right for me as a Presbyterian, a progressive church in Tacoma Park, Maryland, that I raised my son in. My son now goes to Presbyterian College, Worcester, College of Worcester in Ohio. And that's sort of been my path back to my faith. It never left me completely, I believe that. But it took me a while to understand who I was within that faith and how I fit into Christianity and to God's plan. And so that's my journey.
Okay, so obviously most of the student body here today knows your name and who you are from the memoir that's in the curriculum. And this isn't the first year that they've introduced your memoir into class. First question, have you ever, years after you published the memoir, have you ever sat down and read through it as a different person and thought, this man, Michael, in the Peace Corps, are there any disagreements I have with him? Any other conclusions I have? And the second is, have you ever heard again from Raylene McGarity?
What was that? I'm sorry.
Raylene McGarity. That's the...
Oh, Raylene McGarity. Yeah. If I understood you correctly, the first question was, have I ever felt like having a conversation with who I was then? Like, disagreements with?
Right, like, what did you disagree with? Did you ever come to new realizations about your opinions that you thought were completely different from what you used to write about?
Yeah. So I wrote this book when I was a young man. I started writing this book, this memoir, my Peace Corps experience that many of the students here have read, called The Ponza Columbi. I started writing it as soon as I came back from Peace Corps at age 25, and it took me 3 years to write it. I finished writing it when I was 28, almost 28. So that was a while ago. I'm 53 now. 4 years ago, a new edition of the book was published, and I wrote a new introduction. So I had to reread the book and sort of re-experiencing myself as a young man. What's really interesting is, you know, after 20-something years go by since you wrote something, as I read the book, I remember there were some parts of the book, some passages, some chapters that I was really fond of when I wrote them. I thought they were really great, and then when I read them later in life, I thought they were terrible, and I was embarrassed by them. I'm like, God, what was I thinking? And then there were other parts of the book that I barely remember writing. I barely remember being exceptionally proud about this particular story or this chapter. And then as I reread it 20 years later, I thought, my God, that was good. Man. And it's just interesting, you know? They say that the past is a foreign country, you know, when you see a photograph of yourself in the past, you know, you're looking at a foreign country where we all used to live, and rereading a book that I've written is like going back to that foreign country. It's hard to remember who you were and to fully understand that, but it sure is fascinating. And then my Peace Corps trainer, the question was, have I seen this really crazy boot camp type military trainer who was my worst nightmare when I was 22 and went into Peace Corps, who trained all of us for our fish culture training. And the answer is no, I have not. I've not seen her. I've not met her. I hope I never do meet her. And that's a closed chapter.
At the end of your speech, you mentioned sustainability as a part of our American duty. And then you also, throughout your speech, mentioned the goodest American. You use that as this recurring theme of calling us to sustainability, but then you also mention America as being the world's number one problem country. How do you reconcile those two, and wouldn't you think it's more appropriate to call people to sustainability as a duty to being global citizens rather than American citizens?
Good question. Certainly, both. We have an obligation to each other as fellow citizens to do better for each other as Americans. But ultimately, this really is a global issue, which is why when I talk about what motivates me, you know, it's my son, my faith, and my experience among the global poor on this planet, and my sense of obligation to those people all over the world. My grandfather was born during World War I, lived through World War II, had a brother who died in the Korean War, and then my grandfather passed away at a fairly young age during the Vietnam conflict. This was a guy who experienced all that was bad about the 20th century, all the violence, all the conflict. And he used to say, I remember him telling me when I was little, he said, there will never be peace on earth, that human beings just can't get along. And the only thing that would unify all the people of the world to cooperate, all the people everywhere on the planet to cooperate, would be if the planet Earth were attacked by aliens from outer space. Then we would all be unified, right? Then we would be joined in common purpose. And it turns out he was wrong. We don't need aliens to attack us. We're doing a really good job ourselves. Climate change is that issue. Climate change is that threat that can, and I believe will, unify all the people of the world. All the people in Africa with all the people in America and Indiana, and all the people of Bangladesh with the people of South America, because we're all in the same boat, finally. We really are. And it's starting to dawn on us. As the Pope speaks to the 1.2 billion Catholics around the world, we know it's a global issue when he talks about climate change. And then when he says in his encyclical letter that he issued in June, it's a letter, a book-length letter on climate change that he issued not just to the 1.2 billion Catholics on the planet, but he makes it clear that this is an encyclical, this is a message on climate change to all Christians. And not just all Christians, but all people of faith. And not just all people of faith, but he says to all people of goodwill on the planet that we have to come together to solve this problem. So it is a global problem, and we are global citizens. We have to do, you know, if you wanted to be a climate activist, however, if you wanted to pick a place in this whole planet to make the biggest difference as a climate activist, this is the country to do it, because we're the world's biggest burden when it comes to climate change, and we're the country that the rest of the world has in the past and will again follow if we really point the way. And I think we're close to that, but, you know, our government needs more encouragement from us, U.S. citizens, to do better on the world stage.
This is not so much a question for you, Mr. Tidwell, but perhaps for all of us, and an underscoring of something that you mentioned here. But to put it in context, some months ago there was a speaker here and who is the author of Myth of the Christian Nation. Doug, does somebody remember his last name? Anyway, he seems to, well, this room was packed to the gills. I think somebody who was doing the MC of the event mentioned that it may not never have been as full as it was that for that event. And our Mennonite seminary just up the road in Elkhart just had him speak. So he has the ear of the Mennonite church very closely, and he speaks in many ways that people are resonating with, many ways that I think are very healing and important for the Mennonite church and the broader church to hear. However, part of his message, which comes out very strongly, especially in his book, Myth of a Christian Nation, is very averse to political action and engaging with the social, secular structures of society. And we Mennonites have a long-standing tradition of, and it comes out in many different iterations, and ways, but it's very palpable, of being wanting to be very right in our personal lives, very correct in our institutional lives. We want to get it right. We want to do things, and so we green our buildings and our institutions. These, as you said, this is great. We should celebrate this. But if we want to make serious impact, we have to get engaged with policy. And yet we have this whole undercurrent, this theology, this this tradition that runs against that, that this is consorting with the demonic. This is, you know, this is being worldly, all these different ways that we think of it, either subtly and unconsciously or consciously, either individually or collectively. And I think if the Mennonite Church wants to really get on the ball, we have to look closely at this tradition that is keeping us from one of the most important ways of making a difference with whether our children and your child and my sons and their offspring are going to have a livable planet.
Hear, hear. There are a lot of communities who are wrestling with this same question. Labor unions, nurses associations, Christian denominations who traditionally have wanted to just do better in their particular community, inspire and be in community with people and strive for better, but not to reach beyond that, not to get involved in the public square, not to get involved in politics and policy, but who are starting to realize that they have to. This is an unprecedented threat, and we all have to push ourselves outside of our comfort zones. Whatever that comfort zone has been, we cannot allow it to keep us from raising our voices in the political process. Again, this is a nation of laws, and the only way to truly change this nation is to change the laws. And by changing the laws, you have to get involved in the lawmaking process. You have to. People of faith have done that traditionally in this country. The abolitionists, those in the women's suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, and gloriously in the fight for marriage equality that has resulted in such wonderful victories in the last year alone, so many leaders of faith have come around on that. Are we there completely as a faith community? No, but we're night and day where we were before. The Boy Scouts, for example, on that issue alone, very hesitant to get involved and now changing. So we've got to push ourselves and our communities, whatever those communities may be, outside our comfort zone and just realize that there is nothing immoral or truly awkward or wrong or inappropriate about speaking up in the public square, and that ultimately this is the only way that real change happens in this country. So we have to be vocal about it.
Since we're talking about legislation today, Mike, Mary Lee, you spoke with us a little bit about some legislation that you think would make a difference with cap and
dividend.
And why would we as people that are interested in peace and justice want to support such legislation?
Well, yeah, a student earlier today said if you could point to one policy that could solve this problem in America of decarbonizing our economy, what would it be? And I told her that there's this really smart entrepreneur in California named Peter Barnes who founded a company called Credo Mobile cell phone company, which is very popular, successful businessman, Peter Barnes, but he's also very progressive and very concerned about environmental issues and particularly climate change. So he came up with this brilliant idea that we should cap carbon emissions, whenever the oil is coming out of the ground or being offloaded from the tanker from Saudi Arabia, the moment it's coming out of the ground as coal or gas, that polluters should have to pay to sell that fuel into our economy because that fuel is going to lead to global warming pollution. Think about it. A restaurant, you know, at the end of the night, a restaurant can't take all their food and garbage and trash and just drag the bags out into the street and dump the trash in the street. It's illegal. They're not allowed to do that. They have to dispose of their waste, and they have to pay for that disposal. But when it comes to polluting our atmosphere, of dumping our garbage into the sky, it's perfectly legal in this country. It's completely legal to put as much CO2 into the... In 2015, with sea levels rising, with droughts out of control in California, with entire South Pacific island nations disappearing. Think about that. Whole nations being erased from the planet Earth because of sea level rise. These South Pacific island nations, I guess we'll have to go to the UN and New York and have a ceremony where we lower their nation's flag from the United Nations because the nation literally doesn't exist anymore. And even now, as that's happening, it's perfectly legal to put CO2 into the atmosphere in the United States. And it's completely wrong. Peter Barnes has an idea. We cap the carbon. You want to pollute? You want to put CO2 into the atmosphere? You've got to pay the shareholders, the people who own the sky. And that's, he wrote a book called Who Owns the Sky? Does the government own the sky? Of course not. Do the corporations own the sky? No. We all are shareholders. All people in this country have a share in having a healthy atmosphere. So Peter Barnes's idea, his big policy idea, is we put a cap on carbon, we make the polluters pay for putting their garbage into the atmosphere, and that money is then collected and it's redivided. It's sent back to every American in equal shares as a quarterly dividend check. So you would get, under this policy, you would get a check every 3 months that would be made out to you. Every single American, young, old, middle-aged, wherever you live, and it would be the same amount. Whether you're rich or poor or middle class, you would get the same check. And the way this would work is that the carbon fuels would get expensive, so people would be encouraged to buy electric cars, they would be encouraged to buy solar panels, and soon, because of the added price of carbon fuels, we would make the switch to clean energy. And in the process, while that's happening, every American would get compensated for it. And low-income people and the middle class would actually have more money than they had before. Even as energy prices rise, those dividend checks would compensate them. And wealthier Americans, the ones who have 3 or 4 cars, who fly to Europe a lot, have giant homes, use a lot of carbon fuel, put a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere, their dividend check would not cover their expense. They would come out behind. But they're wealthier. That's an incentive to get more efficient, and they have more income to afford this these rising energy prices. So I think it's a beautiful idea. It's also an idea that works for the politicians, because politicians are going to have to start telling their voters, I've got to get rid of oil and coal. We got to get rid of it in our economy, which means a lot of jobs are going to be lost in certain industries. And those industries, the fossil fuel industries, are going to give tons of money to the opponents of members of Congress who embrace any kind of serious climate policy. But under this policy, the voters of that same member of Congress are going to get a check, a carbon check. So there's something in it for the politician. You get to give rebate checks to all your voters at the same time that you do the right thing in capping carbon. So it's a bill that's actually been introduced by my congressman, Congressman Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. It's called the Healthy Climate and Family Security Act. Healthy Climate and Family Security Act. You can go to the website climateprosperity.org, climateprosperity.org, and learn more about it. We good? All right. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much, Mike. Great evening. And reminder, students, ICC students, 9 a.m., we'll talk about the book some more. 10 a.m., convo, how young people can change an old debate. Thanks.